This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with Andrew Marantz, interrogating the American creed of free speech. He's the author of the new book, Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. And you, Andrew, say that free speech doesn't mean what we think it means.
In fact, John Powell, who's a law professor at UC Berkeley, he compared the way we understand free speech to the way most of us understand gravity.
We all think we know what it is, but if you talk to a serious astrophysicist, which I've done, they would say, we have no idea what gravity is, why it works, how it works, and we've been working on it for 100 years.
According to John Powell, there are inherent tensions in the Constitution between different key rights. And he thinks that these tensions are so fundamental that we actually should look at our Constitution as two documents in one. There's a pre-Civil War Constitution, one written before most Americans had full rights. And there's a post-Civil War Constitution, which was designed to extend new rights to more and more groups of Americans. And he thinks these are two conflicting documents that are still, in a sense, at war.
When Lincoln gave his Gettysburg Address, he used the phrase 87 years ago. Afterwards, it was a firestorm because people were pissed, some people, because what Lincoln was doing was criticizing the Constitution. 87 years ago was the Declaration of Independence, not the Constitution. And he was saying that the Constitution was a flawed slave document. And he ended by calling for something radically different than essentially a slave constitution. Here we just had the bloodiest war in U.S. history. It's still a war which killed more people than all the other wars combined. And clearly, there was an effort to do something radical.
The post-Civil War Constitution, the one that began with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, that was supposed to make all people born on U.S. soil citizens, full citizens, with the right to vote, the right to participate fully in democracy. According to these amendments, they now enjoyed equal protection under the law.
The 14th Amendment is designed to bring the freed slaves and blacks generally into the political community. If you're born in the United States, you are a citizen, full stop.
So the problem, according to Powell, is that we never really implemented the post-Civil War Constitution fully. And the court has never really reckoned with the tensions that can arise when you strengthen one right at the expense of another. So if you consider freedom of speech, you can see how strengthening one person's speech rights can actually limit someone else's ability to participate fully in democracy if someone's speech terrorizes someone else into silence.
It's one thing to talk about all these nice and fluffy concepts of free speech and being able to say whatever you want, but in the day-to-day reality of the United States, that just doesn't exist for many people.
P.E. Moskowitz is a journalist and the author of The Case Against Free Speech, The First Amendment, Fascism, and the Future of Dissent. Their book, P.E. uses they-them pronouns, by the way, argues that free speech is not extended equally to all Americans. What Moskowitz is arguing is that we should think less about abstract rights when we think about free speech and more about actual power.
I mean, in the early 1900s, two hardcore union supporter brothers conspired to try to blow up the LA Times, which was a virulently anti-union newspaper. They didn't want to hurt anyone. The point was to call attention to the anti-union behavior of the paper. They ended up hurting people. They ended up getting caught. And the ACLU defended them. You know, they were saying, well, we don't condone blowing things up, but you have to agree that it makes sense that people are this angry because no one is listening to them. Does someone who works 60 hours a week and therefore has no time to attend that council meeting where you could exercise your free speech, do they have a right to free speech? Technically, they do, but in reality, in materialist reality, they do not.
In the middle of the First World War, there was an activist named Charles Schenck who was handing out anti-war flyers urging men to evade the draft. He was sentenced to jail for violating the new Espionage Act, which banned interference with military operations or recruitment. Schenck said that the act infringed on his First Amendment rights, but the Supreme Court upheld the conviction. In fact, one justice, Oliver Wendell Holmes, wrote an opinion saying that Schenck's pamphlets met a, quote, clear and present danger standard, and that therefore the government could send Schenck to jail. Holmes compared nonviolent political protest to shouting fire falsely in a crowded theater.
The U.S. government has decided time and time again that that line between speech and violence should be enforced when it comes to things the government doesn't like, such as leftist agitation, civil rights agitation, and expanded speech, usually at the behest of corporations or the far right.
That precedent was largely upheld for another 50 years. Then in 1969, the Supreme Court went in a pretty different direction. This was in a unanimous opinion in a case called Brandenburg versus Ohio.
Brandenburg was a white supremacist who stood in a field in Ohio and yelled out a speech at a relatively small group of followers.
Susan Benesch teaches human rights at American University, and she's the director of the Dangerous Speech Project, which studies how certain kinds of public rhetoric can lead to mass violence.
He said things like, black people should be sent back to Africa, and he called for also terrible things to be done to Jews. And he was convicted. He appealed his conviction, and the United States Supreme Court decided to overturn his conviction. The Supreme Court decided that it is lawful under the First Amendment even to incite to violence as long as there is not a likelihood that your incitement will lead to what's called imminent lawless action. So that means that I can actually stand in front of a crowd of people and try my absolute best to convince them to go and attack another group of people. And as long as I'm likely to be unsuccessful, that's entirely legal.
Brandenburg essentially enshrined John Stuart Mill's harm principle into law. So for the government to restrict speech, there has to be evidence of physical harm. For instance, neo-Nazi rhetoric about gassing Jews, that might inflict psychological harm on a Holocaust survivor, but as long as there's no immediate incitement to physical violence, the government considers that protected speech. Skokie, Illinois, in 1977, was home to some 7,000 Holocaust survivors. That year, a group of neo-Nazis filed for a permit to march there, promising to wear swastikas and hold signs reading, "Free speech for white Americans."
Wait a minute, man. This is freedom of speech, man.
I use the hysteria of the Jewish community to propel the issue of First Amendment rights for National Socialists and for people who speak up for the white.
The village of Skokie tried to stop the Nazis from marching, but the ACLU took the case to the Supreme Court, and the court upheld the Nazis' right to march.
The speech absolutists try to say, you can't regulate speech.
Berkeley law professor John Powell.
Why? Well, because it would harm the speaker. It would somehow truncate their expression and their self-determination. And say, okay, what's the harm? The harm is a psychological harm. Wait a minute. I thought you said psychological harms did not count. Make a choice. They don't count or they do count. It can't count for the speaker, but not the listener.
The retort of the free speech absolutist is to say, well, the best answer to speech you don't like is more speech. But in practice, it doesn't always work. For instance, in the 1970s, as more and more women started to enter the workplace, their male coworkers were often hostile or outright intimidating. So again, this is the tension between the First and 14th Amendments, between the right to speech and the right to full public participation. Here, the right of the male coworkers to sexually harass the women in their workplace, which is speech, after all, and the rights of those women to fully participate in the workplace. In 1986, the Supreme Court made a decisive turn away from a free speech absolutist position in the case of Meritor Savings Bank FSB versus Vinson. The court declared unanimously that creating a hostile work environment for women was not protected speech.
This actually is a harm. It creates a hostile workplace. Women can't perform.
The court says that sexual harassment in the workplace is a form of discrimination and therefore against the law.
It indirectly requires employers to ensure an atmosphere that is not conducive to sexual harassment and warns them that should they fail, they may be held legally accountable.
That doctrine was later extended to race, but it took a long time. Both of those are saying there's some conditions where you cause a harm and it can't simply be fixed by more speech.
It's not just a workplace issue. If you're an African American intending to vote, and people are holding up signs outside your polling place saying, "I know where you live," those signs are speech, but they're speech that is designed to diminish your full participation in our democracy. Another place where this tension between speech and participation shows up is in the influence of money in our politics. A lot of people are very worried that money has a voice that normal citizens don't. "Don't worry about that," says Mitt Romney. "Corporations are just like you."
"Corporations are people, my friend. We can raise taxes on..." "Of course they are. Everything corporations earn ultimately goes to people. So, where do you think it goes?"
"It goes in their
pockets." What? "Whose pockets? Whose pockets? People's pockets."
In a Supreme Court decision in 2010 called Citizens United versus the FEC, the court granted corporations and unions an almost unrestricted right to use their general funds for, quote, "electioneering communication." This released rivers of cash for political ads. Justice Anthony Kennedy, who authored this ruling, said that these expenditures do not give rise to corruption. And even if there's an appearance of influence, voters still will not, quote, "lose faith in our democracy."
"Political speech is indispensable to decision-making in a democracy, and this is no less true because the speech comes from a corporation rather than an individual."
Justice John Paul Stevens wrote an impassioned dissent, and he said, "Under the majority's view, I suppose it may be a First Amendment problem that corporations are not permitted to vote, given that voting is, among other things, a form of speech."
If you take that kind of hard line, "we'll defend anything as long as it's related to free speech," then you end up defending something that I think is extremely harmful for the U.S.
P.E. Moskowitz.
You know, the ability of people to spend unlimited amounts of dark money getting their preferred candidates elected.
Any argument over the First Amendment is ultimately an argument about harm, about that tension between speech and equal protection under the law. How can it not be? August 12, 2017.
The governor of Virginia says three people are dead following the violence in Charlottesville. A state of emergency declared after white supremacists and counter-protesters clashed.
The common rhetorical pattern in dangerous speech, it is when you accuse another group of doing to your in-group what you'd like to get the in-group to endorse doing to them.
Susan Benesch again. She says that the "Jews will not replace us" chant is textbook dangerous speech, specifically the kind that she refers to as accusation in a mirror.
There are striking patterns that emerge when you look at a lot of this stuff, although I don't recommend doing that, across languages, across cultures, certainly across religions, and even across historical periods. So I thought, if there are these striking patterns, could it be that there is what I call dangerous speech, the category here of language that does something to people such that it's at least a precursor, if not also a prerequisite for mass intergroup violence?
If you are, say, a white supremacist group that is toying with the idea of, getting rid of the Jews, then you might start by accusing the Jews of wanting to get rid of you.
So I began to think about how that could be prevented. I eventually went to law school to become a human rights lawyer. In my first summer in law school, I worked at the UN Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, the War Crimes Tribunal. I was assigned to the prosecution team working on the case of Radovan Karadzic, who was a Serbian civilian leader.
A litany of cruelty.
"Murder, a crime against humanity.
Committed in a war that cost over 100,000 lives, created millions of refugees, and became the darkest chapter of post-war European history.
And I began to wonder, what was it that somebody like Karadzic did that helped to bring about social transformation that makes genocide and ethnic cleansing and other atrocities possible? Since, after all, thousands of people don't wake up all of a sudden one morning and decide that it's a good idea to massacre their neighbors, or even to condone the massacre of their neighbors. If you look at the 1930s in Germany, a remarkably short period passed between the point at which most Germans regarded the Nazis as a disreputable small bunch of street thugs and the point at which a critical mass of Germans began to regard them as a legitimate political force and even to support them. There has to be some kind of a collective psychosocial transformation to make people believe that violence against another group of people is not only acceptable, but necessary.
Andrew?
Yeah.
Can I just cut in here for a second?
Yeah, what's up?
Where are we going with this? Have her observations led you to conclude that white supremacists, whose visibility and noise level have admittedly grown since at least the Obama administration, that they'll ultimately influence the minds of enough Americans that our democracy implodes? Is that what you really believe?
I'm not saying that will necessarily happen, or that it is happening, or even that it's likely to happen. What I'm saying is that given contingency, that is possible. Let's play one more piece of Susan Benesch.
If you wait until a country's about to explode, then you're unlikely to be able to prevent violence. It makes much more sense to start when the situation is not dire. And that's where I think we are in the United States. I am, of course, very worried, but somewhat reassured by the large number of people who are expressing concern about it, since that is one of the important ways, in my view, to diminish the power of such speech.
So, since the 60s, the Supreme Court has really been focused on the rights of individual speakers, on protecting that right. And so the question is, if they were to expand their scope to protect everyone else's rights, the rights of people who are harmed by that speech, what would that actually mean? What would it look like? Would that just destroy free speech as we know it?
Well, that's coming up next. This is On the Media.